From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and there's lots going on. Two big decisions today at the Supreme Court. Actually, one a split decision on immigration. The other a ruling for a college race-based affirmative action program. While in Baltimore, a judge has found another one of the officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray not guilty.
And in the United Kingdom, there is a vote going on right now about whether to leave the European Union or to stay in the EU. Proponents on both sides have been out doing last-minute campaigning. Here's Prime Minister David Cameron speaking yesterday. He wants to stay in the EU.
It's about that word, together. We will win together, fight together, keep the Britain in a European Union together. So let's get out there and vote Remain tomorrow, Thursday.
And here is Conservative MP and former London Mayor Boris Johnson, who wants to leave the EU, speaking in a televised debate on Tuesday.
And if we vote leave and take back control, I believe that this Thursday can be our country's Independence Day.
Joining us now is Sean Curran, political correspondent for the BBC. Hi, Sean.
Hello, thank you.
And first of all, you are somewhat restricted in what you're allowed to say to us today. Tell us about that.
Yes, the BBC operates under very strict rules whenever we get to an election day or a day like today, which is a referendum day. And basically, the BBC, like other broadcasters, isn't allowed to report any details of campaigning whilst people might be out and about voting. And that's for lots of reasons. The BBC has a very strict duty to be impartial. There are also some legal rules that apply not just to the BBC, but apply to everybody. And that means that until 10 o'clock tonight, British summer time, when the polling stations close, we are very restricted in terms of what we can say. And we can't really talk about anything that might in any conceivable way affect how somebody is going to vote, even when I'm talking to you in Boston.
So what are people actually, what happens when people go into the ballot box? Does the question just say stay or go?
Basically, between 7 o'clock this morning and 10 o'clock tonight in the UK, people will go to their local primary school, that's the school for young children, or their church hall or their village hall, or in one or two cases, even the local pub. And there will be set up a makeshift polling station. Their name is crossed off a list. They're given a form and then they go into a little booth, and it's not terribly high tech. They'll find there a pencil with a bit of string on it, and they have to put a cross in a box. And the question on the ballot paper is, should the United Kingdom remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union? It's an exercise in direct democracy. It's very unusual for the UK. We've only had three UK-wide referendums in our history. This is number three. And it is all, as I say, pretty low tech. You just wander down to the church hall, take a piece of paper and put your X in a box.
And is this the kind of vote that some people are not participating in? Is there anybody who just says, I've got to work today, I don't have time to go vote?
Well, there are postal votes for people who can't vote, and we know that postal voting has been a feature of a lot of recent British elections. Not everybody is entitled to vote. The electorate is set out in law. So some months ago now in Parliament, laws were passed setting out what the rules for this referendum would be. But we do know from the authorities that monitor elections in this country is that more than 46 million people are entitled to vote. Mm. So that's a really high number, much higher than we've had in some recent elections. So there are a lot of people who are entitled to vote. The vast majority of them are expected to make that journey down to the polling station. It's actually, in London and the southeast of England, been an exceptionally rainy day. We had thunderstorms last night and floods, and that has actually caused one or two problems. In some parts, they've had to move polling stations because churches or schools have been flooded. Should say, though, just to make it even more complicated, there's one group of voters who don't have to worry about the weather. There are about 20,000 or so people who are entitled to vote in the British Overseas Territory of Gibraltar. And they are almost guaranteed perfect weather today.
Well, and how is this going to work tonight? When will we know the results of this?
10 o'clock tonight, all the polling stations, wherever they are, will close. The ballot boxes are sealed. They're then moved to counting areas. We are hoping that we'll start to get some results before midnight. What will happen is that the counting will continue and we'll get announcements through the night. And the expectation is that probably in the early hours, as most people are waking up and having breakfast, we will start to get an idea of what the result is. It's whichever side gets the most votes, they will have won.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Sean Curran, in London. And presumably, if we talk to him tomorrow, he'll be able to say a whole lot more. Sean, thank you so much. And best of luck in covering this historic day.
Thank you very much. And I promise the next time we talk, I'll tell you a whole lot more.
You'll spill the beans.
Okay. I'll spill the whole beans.
Laws in the UK restrict coverage of the day of votes like the Brexit vote. So joining us now with his thoughts on that and his thoughts on last night's live streamed sit-in in the House of Representatives, NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
So you acquired a memo sent from BBC's chief political advisor, Rick Bailey, to the whole staff. What did it say?
Well, it said essentially that all BBC staffers were not allowed to talk about on the air, online, in social media, whatever, what voters were going to do or what voters had done, more to the point, on the basis of interviews or of exit polls. Now, I actually ended up talking to Rick Bailey, that BBC executive, earlier this morning and asking him a bit about it. He said that essentially that this is mandated, that they're not allowed to by law, and that that in fact that this was a prevention of the use of exit polling, but that nobody had taken exit polls and that therefore, you know, there wasn't going to be this kind of trove of data on which to base such conversations, but that there was a fear that markets in the UK would reflect, the financial markets would reflect private polls that had been commissioned by major investment houses in that country to yield data there, and that if they were to reflect the vagaries of the market going up and down, that they might indirectly be giving ventilation to exit polls there, as though somehow the public wouldn't be able to go on Yahoo Finance and figure it out for themselves.
Well, we're hearing also that they're going to betting parlors because betting parlors have money on the outcome and they're looking to that too. But in a funny way, this is mandated by the government. But does this remind you at all of what used to be not mandated, not the law, but sort of the ethical decision of a lot of broadcasters here in the U.S. not to do too much coverage of the actual day of the voting?
I think that's very fair. I mean, you see it to this day. You see body language being used by broadcasters in this country to indicate sort of sentiment of what they've learned by, call it, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the evening before the polls are shut, even on the East Coast, to indicate the direction things are headed. You can see a buoyancy as they're talking about this candidate, or a deflated sort of countenance as they're talking about somebody who looks like they're going to go down, but they can't say. And that has been the notion, that they don't want to trigger the outrage of the public against saying somehow that somebody else's vote might not count, or the intervention somehow of lawmakers who do have leverage over broadcasters because of the licensing that's involved with you know, the major networks and the regulation of the cable industry as well. So there are ways in which lawmakers have leverage even if they can't interfere with speech per se.
Yeah. Well, let's also address what's going on this side of the Atlantic, the political media struggle that has to do with the sit-in on Capitol Hill, Democrats staying all night to protest Congress's inability to pass meaningful gun control legislation, which is, of course, they're in favor of. And it wasn't just passing it. They just wanted to be able to have a vote. And then the Republicans, as you saw, as we all saw, not on C-SPAN, but we all saw by these various iPhone smartphones that were sending these images out, Republicans came in and pretty much adjourned the session. And here's U.S. Congressman David Cicilline speaking this morning about Republicans literally calling for a session recess and ending everything.
While the American people slept at about 2:30 in the morning, they used a very clever procedural maneuver, and they adjourned.
They went home.
They went home. They walked out on all of these victims, and I can think of nothing more disrespectful to the people they serve, and to the people of this country, than what the Republican Party did tonight.
Rhode Island's David Cicilline. But that's not, as we said, from C-SPAN. It's from a live broadcast on Facebook from another representative. Others were, you know, sending things through different, different online technology. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's a reminder of the way in which the desire to stamp out attention and coverage and publicity for something is very hard to accomplish in the digital age when you can walk in with your own smartphone and make things happen. Members of Congress, some of them in their 60s or 70s, were able to use
Periscope,
you know, the Twitter live streaming app, were able to use Facebook Live. A couple of members of Congress did live interviews from the floor of the House using FaceTime, the Apple app. And, you know, these guys were able to take matters into their own hands. You know, House Speaker Paul Ryan denounced as a publicity stunt. It worked.
It was a game changer. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik.
This Sunday, Ray Donovan returns for a fourth season on Showtime. It stars Liev Schreiber as a Hollywood fixer from South Boston who can make almost any problem go away for the rich and famous, be it an embarrassing photo or a dead body. The one thing that Ray can't fix is his past or his family. His ex-convict father can't stay out of trouble. His brother, a former boxer struggling with Parkinson's, has been shot. And his daughter Bridget is openly rebelling. And this season, the Russian mob will be a problem as well. Joining us now is Liev Schreiber. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much for having me.
And what does it feel like to be returning now for a fourth season with this character?
It feels older. It's, it's an evolution for me as an actor. I'm someone who started in the theater and really couldn't stand repeating the show. My favorite part of acting is the 5 or 6 weeks of rehearsal that you get. I like doing previews. I like the opening week because my friends and family come. And then after that, I don't want to do it anymore. So I'm not particularly suited to this job. And yet I do it. I'm also, you know, as an actor, I'm not particularly suited to hard work. And this is very, very, very hard work. I've never worked so hard in my life. I worked as a mason's helper for my brother. And I remember carrying buckets of bricks up steps of brownstone to build fireplaces, and I thought that was bad, but it pales in comparison to the hours on a one-hour drama.
Well, what is so hard about this one for you in particular?
The hours. Because our show is so cinematic, we're essentially producing half of a feature film in 10 to 13 days. So we're always hustling. And it's also a very emotional show. It's a character who internalizes pain. Mm-hmm. And he's not only does he internalize pain, but he's nonverbal. So unlike Shakespeare, where you get to express through language, with Ray, and it's part of why noir is so great and so cinematic, you're not allowed language. So what you tend to do is amp up a lot of tension, build a lot of tension, and then not express it. And that can be really taxing on the body and the mind.
When you say that, by the way, I think of your role in Spotlight as Marty Baron, who also, in a way, internalizes certain things, and the facial expressions will tell you a lot more in sometimes than the words that you're speaking.
Yes. You know, I think playing Ray in a funny way really helped me get ready for playing Marty. Although I don't think Marty is carrying the pain or the tension or the rage that Ray is carrying. But one thing that Marty, when I met him, that I was aware of immediately that he shares with Ray is that he's a watcher. He is able to gauge a situation very well. And he does it silently and he does it patiently. And once he's made his decision, he executes.
The other thing about these two roles is that Ray Donovan is from Southie, from South Boston.
Yes.
An insider.
And Marty's not.
And Marty is the absolute Boston outsider.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is part of the story of the film. It's kind of what made him uniquely suited to the task at hand.
Well, let's listen to a little bit for people who haven't seen this show, Ray Donovan. This is a little sense of it. Here he is. He's a fixer in Hollywood, so he can kind of get everything done from a work perspective that he needs to. But here he is persuading a talk show host to change the lineup for his show and replace Nick Jonas with an Armenian singer that no one's ever heard of. Here he is.
How's Meg's going on instead?
How's Meg?
Yeah, she's going to do a song about her great-grandfather in Armenian.
What?
You heard me.
Look, if she wants to sing Thighs Go Boom dressed in Golame hot pants, then I will think about bumping Nick Jonas. Otherwise,
she's going to sing a song about Armenian genocide on your show tonight.
Right. And then in terms of his personal life, it seems he can't control anything. Here he is with his daughter.
You say you love me, but you don't. You say you love Mom, but you don't. It's like you're not even alive inside.
You think I don't love you? You gotta know I'd do anything for you.
You control, you don't love. I'm suffocating being near you, and I don't want to live with that anymore.
How do you balance those two parts of this character?
You know, ironically, for a show that is essentially a noir and fraught with sex and violence, one of the things that I love about the character that Anne created is the idea that violent people are only violent because they are vulnerable. Hmm. And that violence is a symptom of vulnerability and fear. And Ray, having suffered some pretty horrible abuse at a very early age, is carrying this around with him, carrying this kind of deep insecurity and vulnerability around with him that I think he has learned to repress and sit on, which has made him sort of a very hard character. I think it also makes violence a natural behavior for him, because there's a lot of anger and a lot of rage. So in terms of dealing with people in the sort of perverse world of the entertainment business, he has a very solid grip on both perversity and violence and dominance. But I think what's really gorgeous about the character comes out with his family, and especially his daughter Bridget, in that scene you just played. Hmm. Because she represents all of his hopes and dreams. She has already exceeded what he is and will become something so much greater than he could ever dream of. And all of his love and all of his hopes are placed in that woman, that girl. That's what I love about him, and that's what I love about the writing on the show, both from David Hollander and Ann Bitterman, that they're interested in those polarities, that duality. That's what makes great dramatic literature. I mean, that's the key to Shakespeare, is duality.
You yourself had a pretty unusual and difficult early childhood. Do you draw on your own experiences at all to sort of hold that pain in?
I think I must, but I don't know. You know, I've never been, you know, a heavy practitioner of the method, or at least with any specific intent. I'm kind of an impulse-based person. Like, you know, I'm sort of waiting for something to happen that I'm not expecting, and I'm kind of want to jump on that train of emotion or whatever it is, both from myself or from the other actor. It usually happens in the interchange between actors, or when you start playing with the rhythms of the scene or mixing it up or moving it around in ways that you're not anticipating it, then emotional things happen. And those emotional things that happen that don't have specific narrative attached to them, I think are always the most interesting ones. Now, of course, those emotions probably come from some history, but I can't remember or connect them. I just know that they exist in my body. And when I work with another good actor, they come out.
So I want to ask you about something that you probably haven't been asked about in a long, long time, but it's the way that I first got to know you as an actor, which is the movie Mixed Nuts that you did in 1994.
Yeah.
You remember that one?
I very well. What an amazing experience that was. I, you know, I got out of school. I was doing $300 a week Shakespeare in the Park. And suddenly I met Nora Ephron, who I guess saw me in a play, and she thought it would be funny to dress me up like a woman. And I agreed. And she was going to pay me in one fell swoop $70,000. I was going to pay off all of my and I had some substantial student loans. I mean, I went to a lot of school. She was going to pay off all of my student loans with one movie. Steve Martin was in it. Rob Reiner, biggest crush of my life, Madeline Kahn was in it. Not to mention that, but like the smoked fish platter that they would put out in the rehearsal room was just like beyond anything. I mean, this was my introduction to the high life, and it was a treat.
And the result for us was, let me just play a little bit. This is you playing Chris, a suicidal transvestite who shows up at a suicide prevention hotline office on Christmas Eve. And here it is.
So hurry down the chimney tonight.
Hello, Lifesavers. May I help you?
May I speak to a woman? May I please wish a woman Merry Christmas?
You are speaking to a woman.
So how many more seasons of Ray Donovan do you think you've got coming?
I don't know. You know, I think that's up to Showtime. It's up to David Hollander. For me, I personally feel like I know the business. I know how the business works. And I know that the shares or the points on the show are more valuable the more episodes you have. But I hope that everyone will also consider the creative element as well, which is to say that as long as there are stories to be told around these characters and as long as they feel compelling and coherent and important and entertaining, we'll keep doing it.
Well, Liev Schreiber, thank you so much for joining us and definitely keep doing it. We all are enjoying all of the work.
Thank you very much.
The puck is about to drop on the Las Vegas Strip. For the first time in that city's history, a pro sports team will play Vegas. The NHL made the announcement yesterday that it's expanding its 30-team hockey league to include the desert town next season. Here's the new team owner, billionaire Bill Foley.
This is Las Vegas's team, and we have 2.2 or 2.3 million local residents, and we sold 14,000 season tickets and season ticket deposits, and we didn't have a team, and we didn't have an arena. Las Vegas is hockey ready. We're convinced of it. We know it.
The team name has not been decided yet, but his first choice would be the Black Knights. So let's bring in Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, historic moment for the city. How hard was it?
Well, it was hard. There was a hurdle to get over just in terms of Las Vegas and the fact that gambling's legal. They've never had a professional sports franchise. History has shown they haven't, I shouldn't say professional sports, they never had a major league franchise. And history has shown that they haven't really supported their minor league franchises particularly well. The minor league baseball team is the lowest in the PCL, Pacific Coast League, in attendance. And they had an arena football team, and that didn't do so well. But I'd say the other big thing is the history of hockey expanding into warm weather places is not that successful at all. And Las Vegas is really warm.
Right. Well, you've said a couple of things. First of all, the concern about gambling, because the concern is that players and franchises would be vulnerable to betting on or fixing games. But also this idea that it's this warm weather place. I mean, the Arizona Coyotes went bankrupt. They had to be taken over by the league before a new owner came in. It was 115 degrees in Vegas the other day. I'm thinking, There might be some questions about energy consumption for a hockey rink.
No. Have you been to Vegas? Have you seen the Bellagio fountain? No energy consumption. There should be, but there isn't. Yes, I think that the heat is more important than the gambling. I think the gambling people at least think they know, and there's some evidence that they know how to deal with that. Gambling is so international, and you could do it online, that the idea of it just worrying about it being in this one locality seems a little antiquated. Now, the heat issue and the fact that there are just so few natural hockey fans in Vegas is something that the NHL denies, and they deny the fact that their franchises in Raleigh and Miami and Dallas are some of the least popular franchises, but facts show that. 538 has done really good analysis showing that the hotter the weather, the least popular hockey is. But there is, I understand, first of all, Foley, who you quoted, who's a West Point guy, that's why he wants to name the team the Black Knights, even though Knights in Vegas are well lit. weird, but he's giving them $500 million. And so that means that the league itself and the other owners who split that money, they can't go wrong with this, even if, you know, the arena shows up half filled on some nights.
Yeah, or there's like a power outage and everything melts. Well, look, because Vegas is now open to this, do you think we might see something like in the NFL, the Oakland Raiders? They're looking for a new home. Might they get other pro teams?
The owner of the Raiders is certainly threatening that or promising that. He wants to turn the Silver State silver and black, he says. But I think the history of the Raiders and the Davis family shows that that's often used as leverage. So as of now, I don't think the NFL is ready to go there.
And football in 115 degrees outside, hard to think of. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Today was a big day at the Supreme Court. The justices ruled that the University of Texas at Austin can consider race as a factor in admissions. They also deadlocked 4-4 on President Obama's immigration plan. That tie means the lower court ruling blocking the president's plan stands. Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate. She is with us from Washington. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And let's start with immigration. Tie vote here on a very big case. Was this expected?
I think it was expected. For those of us who sat through oral argument, it was fairly clear that the court was simply going to be split on the usual conservative liberal lines. I should note that because this was affirmed in one sentence, you know, literally the court publishes something that says affirmed by equally divided court, we don't know how the justices vote. Their names are not on this. But assuming it was the conservatives on one side and the liberals on the other, that was telegraphed, I think, fairly clearly an argument.
And remind us of the case and what was at issue here.
This was a challenge to President Obama's 2014 executive orders on immigration. At the time, he said, I can't get Congress to do anything, so I am going to unilaterally issue some orders that explain what the rules are going to be for deportation. And in effect, what he did was he said, we're going to reprioritize who we deport. We're going to say criminals and drug dealers and multiple offenders are going to bump up the list. And folks who have families here who have been here for a long time are going to have an eligibility to have a kind of quasi-official status and the eligibility to work. So almost immediately that was challenged by 26 states, including Texas, who said that vastly exceeded his executive authority. One district judge in Texas enjoined the entire program, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed. So this was really a challenge that was not litigated in the courts. It was simply a preliminary injunction to Obama's executive order.
And in effect, what you're saying is that the decision of one district court in Texas has now become the law of the land.
Well, that is certainly what the administration is saying. They're saying we can't believe that one judge had the ability to strike down the entire proposition. Certainly, the administration has the ability to challenge this in a different court, in a different jurisdiction. But given that Obama is out of office in November, it certainly looks as though this never goes into effect.
President Obama spoke earlier today about this decision. Let's listen.
But for more than two decades now, our immigration system, everybody acknowledges, has been broken. And the fact that the Supreme Court wasn't able to issue a decision today doesn't just set the system back even further. It takes us further from the country that we aspire to be.
Now, the president went on to make the case yet again that he wants the Senate to at least hear from and confirm Merrick Garland as the ninth seat on the Supreme Court to replace Justice Scalia, who passed away and has made it so that we have these 4-4 ties right now. That's not likely to happen before the election, is it, Dahlia?
It's not likely to happen. I think it's extremely unlikely. But certainly this case, this United States versus Texas, is the highest profile case that splits 4-4, that does all the things that are bad about a 4-4 split, including not ruling on anything, no guidance, no opinion, and having different law in different jurisdictions in the land. So this really is kind of a poster boy case for why eight justices is not awesome. And as such, it's going to push both the issue of immigration and the issue of the vacancy at the court into the forefront for the November election.
Does the administration have any other options here in terms of the immigration plan?
Well, like I say, they can certainly and they may well bring this case in another court in a more favorable jurisdiction and hope for a conflict between two circuits, which then bounces it back to the court. But again, I think we are short on time. And also, until you have nine justices, the court is going to come out the same way next time.
We've seen reaction from a lot of people today, including Jorge Ramos, the Univision News anchor. He says, at the end, it is clear that immigration reform is needed more than ever before and that this is a bad day for Hispanics and that this is going to play into the election. What kind of other reaction are you hearing about this decision at the Supreme Court or this tie?
There was a real crowd out front at the court of families begging for families to be kept together. Lots of posters, lots of signs. I saw tears as I left the court today. I think that the general feeling that there had been a promise that for more than 4 million people could, in Obama's words, you know, come out of the shadows, in Justice Sotomayor's words, come out of the shadows and live and be kind of recognized and work. I think that they're very, very discouraged today. And that was what I was hearing on the flip side, hearing Texas and officials from Texas and the other states that sued saying this is a vindication of the principle that there is no imperial presidency and Obama doesn't have the ability to work around Congress just because he doesn't like what they're doing.
We're speaking with Dahlia Lithwick about the Supreme Court decisions today. She's with Slate. And Dahlia, another big decision that we got today, unrelated to the immigration decision. This is Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin. It was a challenge to the University of Texas's affirmative action program, and the court said the university can legally consider race in the admissions process. Tell us about that one.
This is a case that is back for its second visit at the U.S. Supreme Court. 3 years ago, the court decided what was called Fisher 1. This is called Fisher 2. And it is a petition from Abigail Fisher, a young white woman, who says, I think that the use of race in affording admission places at the University of Texas violates my 14th Amendment right. I think it is a race-based decision-making process. So she challenged it. She, in the first Fisher case, 3 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court kicked it back to the lower courts in Texas and said, look harder, use a stricter standard to determine if we can use race. And today, in a, I think I would say, surprising 4-3 decision, Justice Kennedy sides with the liberals on the court, not only to uphold this race-based part of the Texas affirmative action program, but he has never upheld affirmative action programs. And so this is quite a surprise coming from him. He's quite skeptical of the use of race in higher education. But today he sides with the liberals and says in a very limited way, Texas can go on using race if it fosters diversity in the classroom.
And does this apply nationwide or does this just have to do with the University of Texas?
It applies nationwide insofar as the what was on the chopping block was the principle that in a very limited way, one could use race as a factor in admissions. If that had gone away, I think every affirmative action that used every affirmative action program that used race at all would have had to stop using it. This certainly suggests, as I said, in a very limited way, only to foster diversity and in a very carefully tailored program, universities around the country can use race as one of many, many, I think the words he used were a factor within a factor within a factor in determining admissions.
You can always tell someone who covers the courts because they use terms like insofar as, Dahlia. But thank you for doing that. Let me ask you this. We've got another couple of decisions that we're still waiting for, some big ones, right?
Yeah, I think all eyes are on the court on Monday to finish up. And the one that everybody, the protesters and everybody is mobbing the court is Whole Women's Health. That is the challenge to Texas's HB2, the omnibus, big abortion regulations that were passed, as you'll recall, over Wendy Davis's filibuster. This is without a doubt the most consequential abortion case the court will have heard since 1992's Casey decision. And really, I think everybody is calling their bookie to try to figure out what they can read into what happened today, who has outstanding opinions to write, trying to determine how that one will come down.
Would you say from a legal perspective that Scalia's absence on the court so far has been better for the liberals on the court and what they want to achieve or for the conservatives?
I think certainly with the decision in Fisher today in the affirmative action case, it's probably fair to say that the liberal side of the court is winning more than they're losing, and they're winning in some big ticket cases. But I think both the liberals and the conservatives on the court, and they won't say this out loud, but I think they would say that being hamstrung in this fashion where they either have to decide things very, very, very narrowly or bat them away, I'm not going to say insofar as, but I am going to say in as much as they're not able to do their job very well at now, I think it's a net loss for both sides because the court isn't getting it done.
It's Dahlia Lithwick, who covers the Supreme Court for Slate, talking to us about the two big decisions today, one about immigration, one about affirmative action. You can read more about those at hereandnow.org. And we're going to get more decisions, the rest of them, for the term coming next Monday. Dahlia, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Officials in rural Feasterville, Pennsylvania, are still investigating that 51-year-old man who'd been living for several years with nearly a dozen young Amish girls. One of them had been gifted to him when she was 14 by her financially struggling parents. She then had two children with the man, Lee Kaplan. Her parents say the other nine girls are her sisters, and they've all been living with Kaplan along with their mother. Justine McDaniel is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's with us by Skype. Justine, what more do we know?
So far, we know that the oldest girl was given to him and went to live with him when she was 14. She's 18 now. Officials don't know how long the rest of her sisters were there living with him. But they do know that nine of them were found there along with their mother. And then the girl herself had a 3-year-old and a 6-month-old with him. And her mother also had a 3-year-old. Her youngest sister was 3. So there were 2 3-year-olds found there together. So the age range of the sisters went from 3 to 18 with all ages in the middle.
Well, and we should be clear, according to Philadelphia Inquirer reporting, we don't even really know if it's true that those other girls are the woman's daughters, the now 18-year-old sisters, because there's no Social Security cards, there's no birth certificates?
That's right. Authorities have confirmed that the youngest, the 3-year-old, and the oldest, 18-year-old, are indeed the biological children of the parents, but they haven't officially confirmed the rest of them. There's no birth certificates or anything along those lines. When authorities came to the house acting on a tip from a neighbor, the mother was there, and she told them that the rest of the girls were all her children.
And what are the parents saying that we know about why one child was gifted and why so many others are living there along with a mother?
They were struggling. They live in Lancaster County and have a farm there, and they were struggling with financial difficulties. And they told authorities that Lee Kaplan, who is a businessman and who ended up doing business with the father, Daniel Stolzfus, he came in and helped them out. And in gratitude, they gave their oldest daughter to him. The father told police that he had done some internet research and then concluded that it was okay to do that. And then they told police that Kaplan is a good man and he was helping out their family by helping them care for the other girls.
Well, and this is a family that has said, I mean, they've reportedly said that they gifted at least one child that seems to have had a very rough time. Do we understand the father in 2001 backed over his 14-month-old son with a forklift?
I know there are news reports to that effect. I'm not positive on what happened there. But I do know, you know, they had filed a lawsuit at one time alleging that they'd been discriminated against by their Amish community, and they considered themselves born again Christians and had left the Amish community, although the girls were found in Amish style dresses. At the same time, Lee Kaplan was Jewish and appeared to have been teaching them Hebrew. So it's really not quite known, you know, what their complete past is.
One of the neighbors called. What are the neighbors saying about what they were watching in this house?
You know, neighbors have reported that there was a lot of nuisances coming from the house. They say that Kaplan burned trash in his backyard almost every day and other kind of bothersome things like that. And neighbors said they would sometimes see the girls outside, but never more than a few at a time. And they never, you know, really spoke or did anything. One neighbor said when he tried to wave or smile at them, they would scurry back inside.
Well, one neighbor is quoted saying that they looked frightened and she thought something was not right. But what happens now?
Now, the police on Monday questioned the rest of the sisters, and they didn't find any immediate evidence of abuse. The girls, according to police, seemed fine and did not say that they had been abused. So police are waiting a few more weeks and then going to go back and question them again. Meanwhile, they've pretty much completed, they tell me, their investigation of the house and of talking to neighbors, and they've collected a large amount of evidence from the house, which they said could take several weeks, about a month, to go through.
Well, meanwhile, the teenager who was gifted at 14, mm-hmm. she's reportedly said that she still loves the man she was gifted to.
Yeah. They told police that, you know, Kaplan and the girl were living as husband and wife, and she apparently confirmed that when police interviewed her this week, and said that she also considered him her husband. And you know, one police official said to me she loved him and still does. She still has her two children with her, and the rest of her sisters, since they're underage, are in a safe house where they were taken by Children and Youth Services. But police weren't able to tell me exactly where the 18-year-old and her kids are, but they're still together.
Well, meanwhile, the father has been charged with conspiracy of statutory sexual assault and child endangerment. His wife is charged with endangering the welfare of a child. Is Kaplan charged with statutory rape?
He is, yes. They're all in jail right now, and they have hearings next week.
That's Justine McDaniel with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Justine, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
And we want to underscore that these parents had broken from the Amish community when they made this decision to gift their child. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.